Hi, this is Megan McHugh, and this is the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy, and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia, every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.
G'day, welcome aboard the Starship Zero G, science fiction, fantasy and historical radio for episode number 1585 entitled Console Nation. Thanks to Banksia and Vanessa. Our episode number 1585 is entitled Console Nation Prize, and our podcast title is Pod Laureate. I'm Rob Jan.
And Megan McHugh.
And we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land of the Wurundjeri on which we gather today and broadcast from and to. We would also like to pay our respects to the elders past, present and future. And speaking of elders, going back to Nicolas Cage, Spider-Man Noir.
Yes.
The trailer has dropped.
Yes, we got a little teaser a few months back and we've got quite a longer look now.
Yes, and it's clear that what they're doing, well, it's gone from comic book to character in the Spider-Verse animated movies, voiced by Nicolas Cage, and now brought to vintage black and white or true colour life. You get to choose. It's coming out in Amazon Prime very soon in May, and it's great to see that they've transplanted characters from the modern, well, at least the 1960s, Marvel Universe to the 1940s. So I could see clearly a Kingpin surrogate, Electro and Sandman in there with some of Cage's trademark snark, and also lots of action in it. Looked great.
Yeah, I feel like they sort of saw the appeal that that character had had in the Spider-Man films and they've capitalised on it. And look, what more would you expect?
Yeah. I think actually this is the role he was destined to play.
I think he's in his let's have fun era. And yeah. Also, you know, make some kind of weird little stuff on the side every now and then. But yeah. I definitely think he's out there to have a bit of fun.
Speaking of weird stuff on the side, Jeff Goldblum's in the same country as us at the moment.
Oh, yeah. I think he's also someone who's definitely just happy to cash in on being Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
What's he doing on our shores?
He's brought his band here.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, okay. Well, what's up? Well, I was looking around for a new half-hour sitcom, not necessarily science fiction or fantasy.
Oh.
Though that obviously is a bonus. Yep. Shout out to Mythic Quest. And discovered that old friend Scrubs has a revival season now streaming on, where is it, Hulu and Disney Plus. We've got all the old seasons there too. So Doctors JD and Turk are now Chiefs of Medical and Surgery, respectively, at Sacred Heart Teaching Hospital with some other, which they actually had to rebuild.
Yes, and I think there was some kind of retconning of later seasons of Scrubs.
Yeah.
And now they've kind of just scrapped that and gone back to the original hospital, which I think did burn down in later seasons. Or there was some location change. And I do like they've just gone, we'll just forget that happened and we'll take it back to the environment we love.
Rebuild the decommissioned hospital that we used to film in. So all the familiar faces popping up in for cameos or still on staff. I think they'd had to retire Dr. Cox because he's just so incorrect a character. And a new intake of interns, staff members, of course, ever-changing kaleidoscope patients. The writing seems so far from what I've seen up to par. It's good to welcome it back in such fine form. Yeah. So, from 2001 to 2009, they had their 9 seasons. Mm-hmm. And now this is technically season 10.
It's a very comforting show.
I feel so happy with it.
Just got goodwill at its core. I don't know. I think it's a bit corny, but I don't know. It's nice to have something heartwarming to chuck on.
Yeah, they brought a HR representative into it too to keep them in line.
Good luck.
Well, I thought I might do books today. What did you think?
So we sort of thought, when we were deciding for the lineup for the show, we were going to have a bit of a more literary hour and take our minds away from the screens and into the pages of a couple of books that we've both read. What's your book that you're going to cover today, Rob?
Well, it's a literary detective story, but set against climate change, reaching back from a century in the future. Mm. And yours?
Mine is Super Nintendo, and so it's a little bit about the history of Nintendo as a company and what it's brought to our lives and how it kind of focuses its approach around fun. What's the title of your book?
Oh, it's What We Can Know. So, okay, do you want to play a track before we got into it?
I think let's cleanse our palates and get into the mood for a little bit of gaming chat. Mm-hmm. And I thought that we might listen to a bit of a Nintendo medley.
Yeah.
Because obviously a book called Super Nintendo, we are focusing in on the company Nintendo. This is by String Player Gamer. It's kind of hard to get Nintendo music because they famously don't release it.
Sure.
But this one's a little medley of some very familiar tunes from Nintendo games. So let's hear Nintendo Medley Part 3.
And it comprises what? Pokemon, Yoshi's Island, Luigi's Mansion, and Mario, at least.
So enjoy.
Hello, my name's Sylvester McCoy. I play Doctor Who number 7, and you're listening to me, and you're also listening to Zero G on 3RRR FM.
That was Nintendo Medley, and that was by String Player Gamer, and that compiled a couple of beloved tunes from Nintendo games. We had a bit of an abrupt end there, but I feel like that's akin to, you know, when you've been playing a little too much of the SNES, mum comes in, pulls a plug out of the wall, and then it's game over. So
wait a minute. That's the you used a word that I don't know, SNES. What are we talking about?
Okay, so now, Rob, I am interested, actually, how familiar are you with, like, the cult of Nintendo, like Nintendo as a brand? Obviously you're familiar with some of the characters, but do you know much about what they're about, the history, consoles, that kind of thing?
Nothing, absolutely nothing.
I mean, you did not recognize when I said SNES, so I think that's a clue. But I actually feel like if you didn't know very much about Nintendo, you would still enjoy the book I'm going to talk about today. But I do think you get the most out of it if you're a bit of a Nintendo fan, or at least have a sense of deep nostalgia for Nintendo, the way a lot of millennials do. So the book's called Super Nintendo, and the subtitle is How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. And I think that's a really key distinction to make, is that this book, which is authored by Keza McDonald, who is currently the video games editor at The Guardian and has been in games media for absolutely yonks, has written other titles as well. I think there was one on Dark Souls that she wrote, and she's very well respected in games reporting. But this book is a deep dive into Nintendo, but it's through the lens of the company's dedication to the power of play, to how over many, many years and through the games they've released and the way they've kind of innovated with consoles, hardware and software alike, it's all been with the intention of making games fun and keeping them fun and also making them very accessible. So I think at a time when, I mean, I talk about games on here quite a bit. I love video games. I do think in terms of not just the industry but the communities, it can be fraught sometimes. I mean, we're not going to dig into it too much here. It's not the I don't want to get into that. I want to keep this focused on the fun. But, you know, there's gatekeeping, there's toxicity, there's very much for a long time, a lot of gaming was marketed and was considered to be for one particular audience and, you know, namely a young male audience. And that was a global thing as well and similar to the case in Japan, which is also has fed into Nintendo's approach, which is striving to make it not only more family friendly, but just to build out the community and just draw more and more people into gaming, because I think their ethos is very much that gaming is and should be for everyone because it should be fun and everybody likes to have fun. And so let's break down some of the barriers, and especially as the games industry has like developed over the years, you see Nintendo's dedication to that concept has stayed true. And I think that is kind of what's at the core of this book. And it does a really great job of bringing that sense of surprise and delight through the pages. So I really think McDonald's done a great job capturing the essence and heart of Nintendo. And I can tell that she is a fan and very much respects Nintendo's influence. So I think it doesn't just go through sort of the refreshing approach to gaming. It does it in a very considered way. So there are chapters that sort of starts off, it deep dives into specific games and the early days of game design at Nintendo and the achievements that they were kind of knocking out of the park in way back in the 80s and 90s. So for example, the development of Mario, now iconic and kind of considered, you know, the face of Nintendo. The first Mario game was the very first platforming style game. So a lot of the games that had already existed, and we're talking not just for home systems but also in arcades, none of them really approached platforming game design the way that the first Mario games did. And I think, again, the way the book focuses in on Nintendo's approach to game design, which is in those early days that it was focused around surprising the gamer, like that, you know, you peek down this pipe, you might find a treasure, you might find an enemy, like, you know, experimenting, exploring different elements of these levels. And it was all in the spirit of like curiosity and play and trying to encourage that and do something fresh and new. And from that kind of base, early little bit of history building, the book then goes on. There's also a chapter on Legend of Zelda, for example, which was one of the first open world games where you can kind of, rather than having a very linear set of events, I mean, some would argue that early open world games, they still were quite directive, that you kind of still get funneled down a certain way, even though they purport to be open world. But it was the first style of game where you could kind of go in multi directions or choose your own sort of adventure a little bit. And that was sort of very much embodied how at that point Zelda represented being able to discover an adventure in games. And so again, that's another layer that they're sort of exploring with their company, and which is captured really well in the chapter on Zelda. Of course, we have a chapter on Pokemon and how Pokemon has evolved. And I think, you know, it's now more of a well-known fact, but the mobile game Pokemon Go, you know, where you could go around you could collect, you know, Pokemon would be in your environment. I mean, that was originally a collaboration with Google and Google Maps.
Was Pokemon an animated series or in a manga first, or was it one of those ones that went from game the other way around?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I think it was, it existed already and then it was brought into games.
Okay.
But I think as well, like, it's just getting a little bit of that history and learning about it through the games that Nintendo was designing and releasing, and also looking at the evolution of the different Nintendo hardware. So it does focus on that a little bit.
Oh, good.
In specifically, there is a chapter on the Wii and how the Wii kind of revolutionized, you know, a lot of other companies around the time the Wii was released. Other companies were kind of moving gaming online. Online gaming was getting really big. It was very much about how do we improve graphics and speed. And you know, there is a place for that in games, of course. But it was at this time when everybody was being pushed to online gaming that Nintendo was like, no, no, we're actually going to make something that is a communal console that encourages people to play in the same space as each other. And that was kind of a really risky move at the time. And it worked out for them because the Wii was a really big success. And I found that chapter to be very interesting, and it sort of underlined that Nintendo has been very willing to take chances and be an innovator in that space and do not necessarily just do what everyone else was doing.
Are they the Netflix of these platforms?
Well,
Because they were quite willing to change from renting out DVDs to streaming.
I guess in a way with their business model, yes, Netflix did that. But I'd say the difference would be that Nintendo very much has always kept their user at the core of the experience.
Right. Okay.
And I'd say that each innovation has been not just a challenge for the company, but very much framed around how can we deliver something new to our customer base, and not even just their existing customers. Like, I think an example that the book goes into really well is around how the Wii expanded the audience into people who weren't already gamers, unquote. You know, families, older generation, expanded into a whole audience of people that wouldn't have had any other console in their home until they got the Wii for the first time. And there's stories in the book too about how, you know, the board, they were presenting the Wii console to the board, and like, you know, they couldn't get the board members to stop playing it. Like, they kept being so excited to play the Wii Tennis. And I thought that was just such a really lovely look back on how it was very unexpected at the time. People didn't really know what to do with the, like, when they first unveiled what it was, people were very confused because it was so different to what was everyone else was doing and what people were expecting.
Yeah, because it's more of a, it's almost like a, it is actually like a tennis racket or a golf club or whatever you need to do.
And you're moving through space and, you know, it just was – there was no precedent for it at that time. And I think another innovation that they speak about that McDonald covers in Super Nintendo is around the handheld that, you know, obviously they were pioneers with the Game Boy. But later, you know, they did sort of – reach a couple of dips in the company history, but one of the peaks was definitely when they brought out the Nintendo DS, which moved away from the Game Boy naming, and it was bringing out a handheld console at a time where, again, people were like, why don't you just make your home console better, faster, stronger, more capacity, better graphics? And Nintendo said, no, we want to release another handheld and, again, grow the audience, do fun, interesting things with that console because it had this little touch screen. Mm-hmm. And this was before, like, phones and, like, mobile phones, touch screen, like the iPhone. It was a touch screen release before we touch screens were so ubiquitous in the world. And, again, that expanded the audience into more women were playing, and again they had the games to match. Anyway, I could go on for hours. I do want to talk a little bit more about what's in this book. It's called Super Nintendo, How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. But let's listen to another piece of music. This one is Zelda's Lullaby, and this is a version by Taylor Davis.
This is Kim Stanley Robinson, author of Red Mars, Green Mars, and Blue Mars. You're listening to Zero G on 3RRR.
That was, of course, Zelda's Lullaby, a version by Taylor Davis. Mm-hmm. And we played that because I'm talking about the book Super Nintendo, How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. And it's by Keza McDonald. It's a recent release, so it's only just come out this year. So you should be able to find it at lots of bookstores in the new release section. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this book. I think, like I said, it does help if you have at least a passing interest in learning a little bit about video game history, but specifically if you feel a certain way about Nintendo. I think if you care about Nintendo or want to learn a little bit more about its history, it is famously, it was quite secretive or private. A lot was private about the inner workings of Nintendo for a long time. And I think McDonald's done a really nice job of pulling together quite a large amount of information and history into a very concise and easy to palate book. So as I mentioned before, it is structured in a certain way where each chapter will focus on a specific game title. So for example, I mentioned there's a chapter that focuses on Zelda. There's a chapter that focuses on Mario. There's one on Pokemon. But it's a way to sort of a window in to what's happening either in the game design or technical or hardware innovation inside the company at the time. So for example, the chapter on Wii Sports, as I mentioned, is a really great gateway into the Wii and what a revolutionary console it was. Mm. And it is true to sort of you forget that, I mean, Nintendo, it's a very family-friendly company. There have been times where it's been sort of felt that it was very childlike or conservative. But I think if, you know, in comparison to maybe the sleeker, more sophisticated, older, skewed consoles like things that Sony, PlayStation were doing when Microsoft first came out with the Xbox, Nintendo's sort of colourful, fun approach to everything, you know, it did stick out. It was very much a juxtaposition. But I think that's what you start to really respect as you read the book, that along the way, like, Nintendo's very consistently been able to pivot or change direction, rise to challenges, but also innovate and keep this dedication to gaming should be fun, that it's enjoyment driven and it's not profit driven. Obviously, companies like to make money.
I would think that there would be a profit motive there somewhere.
I do think that, and you know, there's maybe a cultural element here, of course, because Nintendo is a Japanese company, but you know, the book does detail times when they've spent a long time on certain games or given it the space it needs to get it to be the vision that the designers or the programmers want. Even if, you know, taking that time is more risky in terms of the returns. And, you know, they've gone through dud eras, absolutely. And I think, you know, peaks and troughs as with any company, but they've always sort of, I think, bounced back because of what comes through in the book is sort of inside the company. And this was especially obvious sort of during the Iwata years. He was a very beloved CEO of Nintendo for many, many years, that it was very much about collaboration inside the company, that people would help each other, that people would have, you know, a vision and they would work together to reach these kind of shared goals. And I think, you know, there's a lot of companies that just don't seem to have
outrageous
that happening on the inside, especially in the games industry at the moment. You know, there's layoff after layoff, you know, kind of controversy after controversy. But, and I'm sure it's probably not all roses, but, you know, it's not just them have Nintendo having the strongest branding on the planet that has kept them sort of standing. It is funny. I mean, Nintendo's also a famously litigious company. And I have known this tidbit before, but so litigious in a way, Kirby is actually named after a lawyer that works for Nintendo once defending them in a lawsuit about, like, Donkey Kong, King Kong, this whole thing. Mm. So they named Kirby's actually named after one of Nintendo's lawyers in the US. But I just, overall, I really enjoyed a lot of the information. Look, I'll be honest, as someone who likes to read, you know, long-form articles, is fairly engaged, you know, I knew some of these things already.
Sure.
And some of the discussions around the games and things, it wasn't necessarily all new information, but I thought the way it was presented, and especially focusing around that spirit of play, I thought was a really nice way to look at it. Also, you know, I love anything that looks at kind of the early days of game development in the 80s and 90s, and that's where the book kind of starts out. And just, you know, remembering that there was a time when game designers really had to work within hardware and software limitations, and a lot of that shaped how certain things look or are now. Like Yoshi's design is very much a result of the fact that only a certain amount of pixels were available. So when Mario's riding Yoshi, you know, it could only be X pixels high. So, okay, what can, working within that, what can Yoshi even be? Like, it wasn't that someone said, let's make him like a dinosaur. It was like, okay, the shape, this is the shape we have.
Yeah, yeah.
What does that shape look like? And I find that stuff really, really interesting to kind of reflect on how far we've come.
It's like the QWERTY keyboard.
Yes. What about the QWERTY keyboard?
Yeah. Now, you know, the original mechanical layout to help facilitate the keys not ramming into each other and getting stuck. And now it's become what it's still
it's the standard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and people look at on computers, they look at the little icon for saving files.
Yes.
What the hell is that?
Yeah. Like, it's a vending machine.
Yeah.
I do think the highlight and where the book hits its stride is in the chapter, which does focus on Satoru Iwata, who was the CEO I mentioned before. And I think a lot of this ethos, you know, caring about the player, having good solid designs, embracing fun, comes from his approach to running the company. Like, it's a top down thing. And you know that all gamers should be treated equally, casual gamers, hardcore quote unquote gamers. And I think very much so, it's like, okay, it's not about building skills, when it's not about these barriers you have to overcome to be enjoying our games. It's like, it's truly for everybody. So I found the chapter on Iwata to be really moving. I thought that was a really nice a position in the book too, to kind of, you're like, oh, I see how all of this has come together, all these like kind of magical elements just to make the perfect chemistry to allow a company to, yeah, just I take these risks and come out with these consoles and games that still bring a lot of joy today, like decades later. And I think Iwata had a quote, which I think is kind of a nice way to wrap this up. And it was, Nintendo's mission is to try to make people happy, to try to make people smile.
Oh.
I mean, what a great mission.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of shows in some of the business decisions that they've made over the years. So the book is Super Nintendo, How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. It's by Keza McDonald. It's a fairly recent release. I really enjoyed it. I do think that obviously if you feel you don't want to read a whole book about the history of Nintendo, I mean, it may not be for you, but I think it's really organized in a way that makes it just whiz by.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it talks a bit about the Animal Crossing surge of COVID era, and just it really reminds you that games have such a power for connection and community. And I think that's a really nice time to remember that, given that, you know, it's such a wide landscape now, and that not all patches are this fun and this focused on just making sure people enjoy gaming.
You know, there's a book about the Tamiya model making company, which sounds very much like that, you know, hitting all the highlights along the way, but emphasizing the fact that they want to have fun and they want people to buy the product to have fun.
Exactly.
And it
and the more the merrier, like that kind of mindset.
Well, obviously that's good for profits, but at the same time, at the same time, I felt when I read that book that it gave me an insight into the idea of the craft over the company, you know, but at the same time, of course, they have to they have to blend along the way.
Yes, it's like all of the elements, just the right amount of focus on each one to come together in this really nice mix. But anyway, I do recommend the book. I very much enjoyed it. Super Nintendo, How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. Let's take a little bit of music to lead us into
Animal Crossing.
The book that you're going to speak. Yes, look, I have to seize my opportunity whenever I can. We'll listen to a little bit of Animal Crossing Lo-Fi. This is a version by Jack the Pug.
Hello, this is Charlie Hayes. I've played several characters in various Big Finish audios, alongside, probably more famously, my Helena Bonham Carter gasp. Do you recognise it? You're listening to Zero G on 3RRFM. Zero G, you heard it here first.
Yeah, we've been crossing with the animals there.
Yes, that was Animal Crossing Lo-Fi version by Jack the Pug in celebration of the book I just covered, Super Nintendo. And just another reminder that we still have a couple more days left of April Amnesty. And that is our annual drive to just remind you it's a great time to subscribe or donate to the station and to escape that crushing guilt of not subscribing. And I would say if you already are guilt-free and a happy subscriber, happy as a pig in mud, and you do have the means, you could throw us a little extra with a donation as well. That is always welcome during this time, and it all counts to keep us going as community-funded community radio.
And we promise that we won't send the boys around because they're far too busy facing off against Homelander. Episode of The Boys last night had a really great line. They were talking about plants using viruses to control human beings. Mm-hmm. One of them popped up and said, one of the characters popped up and said, oh, like The Last of Us. And Frenchie replied quickly, no, that's just The Walking Dead with mushrooms. Where would you get that anywhere else on the planet but Zero G and RRRFM? So, yeah.
It's true.
I want to mention the Fantastic Film Festival in Australia, which is out now, running between the Lido Cinemas, Thornbury Picture House and Brunswick Picture House. Started on the 23rd of April, going through to the 15th of May or the 12th of May, depending on which venue you're going to. Focusing upon alternative cinema, they've got Q&A screenings, they've got some classics, restorations and some short films and so on in contention in the competition that they've got there. And it's spread across screens in Melbourne and Sydney as well. So this is like all over the country. Mm-hmm. They've got Japanese Nightmares as one focus, seven films highlighting J-horror's impact on genre, with films like Ichi the Killer from 2001, Onibaba from 1964, going through to Tetsuo, the Iron Man, which is a hell of a film if you've ever seen it, and a sequel. They've also got Vampire Weekend selections, which include Let the Right One In, the Swedish version. Mm-hmm. The US version is pretty good too.
It is pretty good, yeah.
That Romero classic Martin from 1977. Near Dark, you know, that rollicking Texicana sort of Western Vampire one, 1987, Nosferatu, the Vampire, and that's the Herzog one.
From the OG.
The 79 one.
Well, not the OG, but yeah. The OG. Not the recent one.
Yeah, and of course the Lost Boys as well. How can you not have that? Nice. The Rat Pack. and Twilight as well. we'll pass on.
Twilight
as well, yeah, sparkling away there forever. And then there's also four feature-length Australian films screening in competition for a $10,000 cash prize, including Lenore, Wolf Cat Fever, Squids and Cruel Hands. Nice. And this is all at the Fantastic Film Festival 2026.
Nice.
Now, I'm going to roll forwards into the future or float into the future with a book called What We Can Know by Ian McEwan. It's Jonathan Cape, a.k.a. Penguin Random House imprint from 2025. Now, Ian Russell McEwan is a British novelist and screenwriter. Yonks lashes of books, a few short stories and so on to his name, many of which have been adapted into films or TV shows. You might know his novels, The Children Act, Nutshell and Machines Like Me. And so this is his latest novel. And a while ago, I wrote that a science fiction novel set on Earth in the near to long-term future has to factor in anthropogenic climate change to be credible. And in looking at this book by McEwan. I'm never entirely sure if he intends global warming to be in the fore, the middle, or the background, as he sort of shifts the focus over the course of the story. But it's a deft shift. Not to worry, he consistently features the high ground as a necessary consequence of the United Kingdom in 2119 being transformed by rising sea levels into a series of diverse islands. So the British islands really lean into it there. But 22nd century civilization carries on, albeit transformed by the climate chaos of the 21st. On one island, Tom Metcalf is a scholar teaching in the literary section of the Arts and Humanities Department at a university. It's by no means the star department at the uni, a spot taken by the more immediately, urgently practical science-based faculties, who get the bulk of the funding, limited computer time and other resources, like AI is kind of restricted to people who really need to use it. Still, I take comfort from the fact that there's an official interest in the arts at all, which speaks well of a culture that would otherwise might be rather justified in completely focusing upon simple, sustainable survival after all they've been through during and after. The derangement.
The derangement?
Yeah, of the past 100 years. So called because the people of those pre-inundation times, us, knew very well what harm they were literally baking into the future. But from the perspective of the ravaged future, inexplicably, we did not do enough to mitigate it.
Well.
So I'm afraid my solar panels are just not cutting it. Now, in one of the more whimsical setups I've encountered for a science fiction novel, Tom's primary historical academic literary interest is a legendary poem.
That's the McEwan of it all, I think.
A Corona for Vivian, written in 2014 by the eccentric poet Francis Blundy as a gift for his wife's 54th. It was read out in public once, if you can call it public, because it was at a small party of luminary friends.
Of course, okay.
Which is now famous in the future. It has become known as the Second Immortal Dinner.
Oh.
Now, I pause to note that the First Immortal Dinner took place in 1817 in London, hosted by Ben Hayden, the painter, with William Wordsworth, John Keats and Charles Lamb amongst the guest list.
Got it, okay.
So the second scene from yet another century on is seen as equally intellectually pivotal, and it struck a chord. Now, the Corona, as it's known, and that is actually a form of poetry as well that I won't go into. I'll let McEwan explain that in the book. It exists only as some admittedly well-remembered lines, quoted by its small but impressed audience, and for the large negative space it left. So that's been fueled by growing and endless speculation amongst the general literary and academic public. The Corona struck a chord by strikingly and powerfully entwining.
How could it be so enduring and yet not be remembered in full?
Well, it's like many things about that.
Yeah,
like
I guess some things get lost to time, or it's only the most colourful or strongest elements of a thing that persists and the rest gets, you know, fades away. But okay.
So what it's done is it, it entwines romantic and environmental themes in a fashion that's echoed down through the decades, resonating deeply with the zeitgeist and spawning enduring multimedia reflection online, on the screen, and in many books, both popular and esoteric. It's become a kind of a literary holy grail.
Okay, yeah.
Now, Tom is the latest in a long line of knowledge knights who desire to achieve this grail.
Intellectuals are funny.
Yeah. But unlike his dogged predecessors, he's lucky enough to be in the right place and time when a possible clue surfaces to the whereabouts of a copy of the precious poem. There's much more to it than that. And unlike,
it's on Tumblr. Continue, sorry.
And unlike Ian McEwan, who wrote the book rather than merely reviewing it like I am, I get to cut that long story shorter. Still, I have to underline the key fact that Tom's then partner and colleague, Rose, is a scholar in her own right, instrumental in the quest, even though she doesn't initially physically accompany him.
Yep.
But this neatly reflects the relationship between the poet Francis and his wife Vivian, who is so very, very much more above and beyond just being an artistic muse.
Yeah.
And who, in fact, is actually the main driver of the story, even 100 years on in their future.
This is a pattern in history, isn't
it? It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not easy getting about the inundated land. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes it's as easy as getting on a ferry.
I was going to say, it's just a bunch of islands.
Yeah. But Tom is obsessed and a fan, and we know how that goes.
Well, yeah.
Arthurian.
One-track mind.
Yeah, pretty much. In fact, he does actually go up a track at one stage, one of those funicular railroads.
Oh, yeah.
Arthurian enthusiasts will well know that often the most interesting thing about the Holy Grail lies more in the quest.
Yes.
Rather than in the finding of the thing. And as an amused aside, knowing that several of Ian McEwan's stories have been adapted to the screen, I cannot help but think that Chris O'Dowd...
Oh, you think he'd be a good...
He'd be a good Tom.
Yeah.
I think he'd have the right amount of differing and indecisively offbeat energy.
Yeah.
And his range across the IT crowd and the Big Door Prize and Small Town, Big Story would surely suggest he'd kind of gently, awkwardly nail it.
Yeah, like ramshackle intellectual. I can see it.
Following along that line, I'd really like to picture Tamsin Grigg from Black Books playing Rose. But I'm going to press pause on my fantasy casting there.
Well, let's put it out into the universe. I like that. Yeah, you know, who knows? Yeah.
Although anchored to a sharper point in the future, the story flashes back fluidly to our contemporary time, more or less, as Vivian and Francis's personal stories play out over several decades now.
Okay. Yep.
So if you've read McEwan's work or seen an adaptation, you'll know they often revolve around families under peculiar stresses and severe tensions and quite often a crime.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it is here. So
atonement.
Atonement. Megan's ballpark here. Crime. Vivian has a complicated backstory with her first husband before Francis, and there are many trapdoors open to us, the readers, that Tom cannot possibly enter from his position in the future. Even though he has fortunate access to quite a lot of archival material about the famous couple.
How fortunate for story purposes.
The reader should be prepared to spend a reasonable amount of time in remote libraries and other repositories. And yes, the literary detective story is also paralleled by the unravelling of one or perhaps more historical crimes. So McEwan's kind of modestly / cheekily said that what we can know is science fiction without the science. And that's true to some extent. But on the other hand, I'm struck by the deftness of which he casually stuns with some memorable telling details. For example, from the derangement, a character's chilled by video footage of a sinking, capsizing US American aircraft carrier with sailors sliding off its tilted flight deck into the water. Mm. And that's a scenario which cannot fail to immediately provoke emotion in any 2026 reader.
Yeah.
So let's have a track here. There is no sound.
On that note.
no soundtrack to this, but although that has happened in the past with novels. But I think I'll go with this one. It's called Shattered Garden, featuring Maggie Richardson. It is a song about climate change, and it is by the Steer Inspired Orchestra. And it's about a bird flying through a polluted landscape and hopefully looking forward to a better future.
Oh.
Or not. G'day. Welcome aboard the Starship Zero-G, science fiction, fantasy and historical radio for episode number 1585, entitled Console Nation, thanks to Banksia and Vanessa. Our episode number 1585 is entitled Console Nation Prize, and our podcast title is Pod Laureate. I'm Rob Jan.
And Megan McHugh.
And we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land of the Wurundjeri on which we gather today and broadcast from and to. We would also like to pay our respects to the elders past, present and future. And speaking of elders, going back to Nicolas Cage, Spider-Man Noir.
Yes.
The trailer has dropped.
Yes, we got a little teaser a few months back and we've got quite a longer look now.
Yes, and it's clear that what they're doing, well, it's gone from comic book to character in the Spider-Verse animated movies, voiced by Nicolas Cage and now brought to vintage black and white or true colour life. You get to choose. It's coming out in Amazon Prime very soon in May, and it's great to see that they've transplanted characters from the modern, well, at least the 1960s, Marvel Universe to the 1940s. So I could see clearly a Kingpin surrogate, Electro and Sandman in there with some of Cage's trademark snark, and also lots of action in it. Looked great.
Yeah, I feel like they sort of saw the appeal that that character had had in the Spider-Man films, and they've capitalized on it. And look, what more would you expect?
Yeah. I think actually this is the role he was destined to play.
I think he's in his let's have fun era. And yeah. Also, you know, make some kind of weird little stuff on the side every now and then. But yeah. I definitely think he's out there to have a bit of fun.
Speaking of weird stuff on the side, Jeff Goldblum's in the same country as us at the moment.
Oh, yeah. I think he's also someone who's definitely just happy to cash in on being Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
What's he doing on our shores?
He's brought his band here.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, okay. Well, what's up? Well, I was looking around for a new half-hour sitcom, not necessarily science fiction or fantasy.
Oh.
Though that obviously is a bonus. Yep. Shout out to Mythic Quest. And discovered that old friend Scrubs has a revival season now streaming on, Hulu and Disney Plus. We've got all the old seasons there too. So Doctors JD and Turk are now chiefs of medical and surgery, respectively, at Sacred Heart Teaching Hospital with some other, which they actually had to rebuild.
Yes, and I think there was some kind of retconning of later seasons of Scrubs.
Yeah.
And now they've kind of just scrapped that and gone back to the original hospital, which I think did burn down in later seasons, or there was some location change. And I do like they've just gone, we'll just forget that happened, and we'll take it back to the environment we love.
Rebuild the decommissioned hospital that we used to film in. So all the familiar faces popping up in for cameos or still on staff. I think they'd have had to retire Dr. Cox because he's just so incorrect a character. And a new intake of interns, staff members, of course, ever-changing kaleidoscope of patients. The writing seems so far from what I've seen up to par. It's good to welcome it back in such fine form. So, from 2001 to 2009, they had their 9 seasons. Mm-hmm. And now this is technically season 10.
It's a very comforting show.
So happy with it.
Just got goodwill at its core. I don't know. I think it's a bit corny, but I don't know. It's nice to have something heartwarming to chuck on.
Yeah, they brought a HR representative into it too to keep them in
good
line.
Good luck.
Well, I thought I might do books today. What did you think?
Yes, so we sort of thought, when we were deciding for the lineup for the show, we were going to have a bit of a more literary hour and take our minds away from the screens and into the pages of a couple of books that we've both read. What's your book that you're going to cover today, Rob?
Well, it's a literary detective story, but set against climate change, reaching back from a century in the future. Mm. And yours?
Mine is Super Nintendo, and so it's a little bit about the history of Nintendo as a company and what it's brought to our lives and how it kind of focuses its approach around fun. What's the title of your book?
Oh, it's What We Can Know. So, okay, you wanted to play a track before we got into it?
I think let's cleanse our palates and get into the mood for a little bit of gaming chat. Mm-hmm. And I thought that we might listen to a bit of a Nintendo medley.
Yeah.
Because obviously a book called Super Nintendo, we are focusing in on the company Nintendo. This is by String Player Gamer. It's kind of hard to get Nintendo music because they famously don't release it.
Sure.
But this one's a little medley of some very familiar tunes from Nintendo games. So let's hear Nintendo Medley Part 3.
And it's comprised of what? Pokemon, Yoshi's Island, Luigi's Mansion and Mario at least.
So enjoy.
Hello, my name is Sylvester McCoy. I play Doctor Who number 7 and you're listening to me and you're also listening to 0G on 3RRR FM.
That was Nintendo Medley, and that was by String Player Gamer, and that compiled a couple of beloved tunes from Nintendo games. We had a bit of an abrupt end there, but I feel like that's akin to, you know, when you've been playing a little too much of the SNES, mum comes in, pulls a plug out of the wall, and then it's game over. So
wait a minute.
That's the
you used a word that I don't know, SNES. What are we talking about?
Okay, so now, Rob, I am interested, actually, how familiar are you with, like, the cult of Nintendo, like Nintendo as a brand? Obviously you're familiar with some of the characters, but do you know much about what they're about, the history, consoles, that kind of thing?
Nothing, absolutely nothing.
I mean, you did not recognize when I said SNES, so I think that's a clue, but I actually feel like if you didn't know very much about Nintendo, you would still enjoy the book I'm going to talk about today. But okay. I do think you get the most out of it if you're a bit of a Nintendo fan, or at least have a sense of deep nostalgia for Nintendo, the way a lot of millennials do. So the book's called Super Nintendo, and the subtitle is How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. And I think that's a really key distinction to make, is that this book, which is authored by Keza McDonald, who is currently the video games editor at The Guardian and has been in games media for absolutely yonks, has written other titles as well. I think there was one on Dark Souls that she wrote, and she's very well respected in games reporting. But this book is a deep dive into Nintendo, but it's through the lens of the company's dedication to the power of play, mm-hmm. to how over many, many years and through the games they've released and the way they've kind of innovated with consoles, hardware and software alike, it's all been with the intention of making games fun and keeping them fun and also making them very accessible. So I think at a time when, I mean, I talk about games on here quite a bit. I love video games. I do think in terms of not just the industry but the communities, it can be fraught sometimes. I mean, we're not going to dig into it too much here. It's not the I don't want to get into that. I want to keep this focused on the fun. But, you know, there's gatekeeping, there's toxicity, there's very much for a long time a lot of gaming was marketed and was considered to be for one particular audience, and, you know, namely a young male audience. And that was a global thing as well, and similar to the case in Japan, which is also has fed into Nintendo's approach, which is striving to make it not only more family-friendly, but just to build out the community and just draw more and more people into gaming, because I think their ethos is very much that gaming is and should be for everyone, because it should be fun. And everybody likes to have fun. And so let's break down some of the barriers, and especially as the games industry has, like, developed over the years, you see Nintendo's dedication to that concept has stayed true. And I think that is kind of what's at the core of this book. And it does a really great job of bringing that sense of surprise and delight through the pages. So I really think McDonald's done a great job capturing the essence and heart of Nintendo. And I can tell that she is a fan and very much respects Nintendo's influence. So I think it doesn't just go through sort of the refreshing approach to gaming. It does it in a very considered way. So there are chapters that sort of starts off, it deep dives into specific games and the early days of game design at Nintendo and the achievements that they were kind of knocking out of the park in way back in the 80s and 90s. So, for example, the development of Mario, now iconic and kind of considered, you know, the face of Nintendo. The first Mario game was the very first platforming style game. So a lot of the games that had already existed, and we're talking not just for home systems but also in arcades, none of them really approached platforming game design the way that the first Mario games did. And I think, again, the way the book focuses in on Nintendo's approach to game design, which is in those early days that it was focused around surprising the gamer, like that, you know, you peek down this pipe, you might find a treasure, you might find an enemy, like, you know, experimenting, exploring different elements of these levels. And it was all in the spirit of, like, curiosity and play and trying to encourage that and do something fresh and new. And from that kind of base, early little bit of history building, the book then goes on. There's also a chapter on Legend of Zelda, for example, which was one of the first open world games where you can kind of, rather than having a very linear set of events, I mean, some would argue that early open world games, they still were quite directive, that you kind of still get funneled down a certain way, even though they purport to be open world. But it was the first style of game where you could kind of go in multi directions or choose your own sort of adventure a little bit. And that was sort of very much embodied how at that point Zelda represented being able to discover an adventure in games. And so again, that's another layer that they're sort of exploring with their company, and which is captured really well in the chapter on Zelda. Of course, we have a chapter on Pokemon and how Pokemon has evolved. And I think, you know, it's now more of a well-known fact, but the mobile game Pokemon Go, you know, where you could go around you could collect, you know, Pokemon would be in your environment. I mean, that was originally a collaboration with Google and Google Maps.
Was Pokemon an animated series or an Among the first, or was it one of those ones that went from game the other way around?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I think it existed already, and then it was brought into games.
Okay.
But I think as well, like, it's just getting a little bit of that history and learning about it through the games that Nintendo was designing and releasing, and also looking at the evolution of the different Nintendo hardware. So it does focus on that a little bit.
Oh, good.
In specifically, there is a chapter on the Wii and how the Wii kind of revolutionized, you know, a lot of other companies around the time the Wii was released. Other companies were kind of moving gaming online. Online gaming was getting really big. It was very much about how do we improve graphics and speed. And you know, there is a place for that in games, of course. But it was at this time when everybody was being pushed to online gaming that Nintendo was like, no, no, we're actually going to make something that is a communal console that encourages people to play in the same space as each other. And that was kind of a really risky move at the time. And it worked out for them because the Wii was a really big success. And I found that chapter to be very interesting, and it sort of underlined that Nintendo has been very willing to take chances and be an innovator in that space and do not necessarily just do what everyone else was doing.
Are they the Netflix of these platforms?
Well, I...
Because they were quite willing to change from... being a renting out DVDs to streaming.
I guess in a way with their business model, yes, Netflix did that. But I'd say the difference would be that Nintendo very much has always kept their user at the core of the experience. Okay. And I'd say that each innovation has been not just a challenge for the company, but very much framed around how can we deliver something new to our customer base, and not even just their existing customers. Like, I think an example that the book goes into really well is around how the Wii expanded the audience into people who weren't already gamers, unquote. You know, families, older generation, expanded into... Yeah, a whole audience of people that wouldn't have had any other console in their home until they got the Wii for the first time. And there's stories in the book too about how, you know, the board, they were presenting the Wii console to the board, and, like, you know, they couldn't get the board members to stop playing it. Like, they kept being so excited to play the Wii tennis. And I thought that was just such a really lovely look back on how it was very unexpected at the time. People didn't really know what to do with the, like, when they first unveiled what it was, people were very confused because it was so different to what was everyone else was doing and what people were expecting.
Yeah, because it's more of a, it's almost like a, it is actually like a tennis racket or a golf club or whatever you need to do.
And you're moving through space and, you know, it just was, it, there was no precedent for it at that time. And I think another innovation that they speak about that McDonald covers in Super Nintendo is around the handheld that, you know, obviously they were pioneers with the Game Boy, but later, you know, they did sort of reach a couple of dips in the company history, but one of the peaks was definitely when they brought out the Nintendo DS, which moved away from the Game Boy naming, and it was bringing out a handheld console at a time where, again, people were like, why don't you just make your home console better, faster, stronger, more capacity, better graphics? And Nintendo said, no, we want to release another handheld and, again, grow the audience, do fun, interesting things with that console, because it had this little touch screen. Mm-hmm. And this was before, like, phones and, like, mobile phones, touch screen, like the iPhone. It was a touchscreen release before we touchscreens were so ubiquitous in the world. And again, that expanded the audience into more women were playing, and again, they had the games to match. Anyway, I could go on for hours. I do want to talk a little bit more about what's in this book. It's called Super Nintendo, How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. But let's listen to another piece of music. This one is Zelda's Lullaby, and this is a version by Taylor Davis.
This is Kim Stanley Robinson, author of Red Mars, Green Mars, and Blue Mars. You're listening to Zero G on 3RRR.
That was, of course, Zelda's Lullaby, a version by Taylor Davis. Mm. And we played that because I'm talking about the book Super Nintendo, How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. And it's by Keza McDonald. It's a recent release, so it's only just come out this year. So you should be able to find it at lots of bookstores in the new release section. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this book. I think, like I said, it does help if you have at least a passing interest in learning a little bit about video game history, but specifically if you feel a certain way about Nintendo. I think if you care about Nintendo or want to learn a little bit more about its history, it is famously, it was quite secretive or private. A lot was private about the inner workings of Nintendo for a long time. And I think McDonald's done a really nice job of pulling together quite a large amount of information and history into a very concise and easy to palate book. So as I mentioned before, it is structured in a certain way where each chapter will focus on a specific game title. So, for example, I mentioned there's a chapter that focuses on Zelda. There's a chapter that focuses on Mario. There's one on Pokemon. But it's a way to sort of a window in to what's happening either in the game design or technical or hardware innovation inside the company at the time. So, for example, the chapter on Wii Sports, as I mentioned, is a really great gateway into the Wii and what a revolutionary console it was. And it is true to sort of you forget that, I mean, Nintendo, it's a very family-friendly company. There have been times where it's been sort of felt that it was very childlike or conservative. But I think if, you know, in comparison to maybe the sleeker, more sophisticated, older, skewed consoles like things that Sony, PlayStation were doing when Microsoft first came out with the Xbox, Nintendo's sort of colourful, fun approach to everything, you know, it did stick out. It was very much a juxtaposition. But I think that's what you start to really respect as you read the book, that along the way, like, Nintendo's very consistently been able to pivot or change direction, rise to challenges, but also innovate and keep this dedication to gaming should be fun, yeah, that it's enjoyment driven and it's not profit driven. Obviously, companies like to make money.
I would think that there would be a profit motif there somewhere.
I do think that, and you know, there's maybe a cultural element here, of course, because Nintendo is a Japanese company, but you know, the book does detail times when they've spent a long time on certain games or given it the space it needs to get it to be the vision that the designers or the programmers want, even if, you know, taking that time is more risky in terms of the returns. And, you know, they've gone through dud eras, absolutely. And I think, you know, peaks and troughs as with any company, but they've always sort of, I think, bounced back because of what comes through in the book is sort of inside the company. And this was especially obvious sort of during the Iwata years. He was a very beloved CEO of Nintendo for many, many years, that it was very much about collaboration inside the company, that people would help each other, that people would have, you know, a vision and they would work together to reach these kind of shared goals. And I think, you know, there's a lot of companies that just don't seem to have
outrageous
that happening on the inside, especially in the games industry at the moment. You know, there's layoff after layoff, you know, kind of controversy after controversy. But, and I'm sure it's probably not all roses, but, you know, it's not just them Nintendo having the strongest branding on the planet that has kept them sort of standing. It is funny. I mean, Nintendo's also a famously litigious company. And I have known this tidbit before, but so litigious in a way, Kirby is actually named after a lawyer that works for Nintendo once defending them in a lawsuit about, like, Donkey Kong, King Kong, this whole thing. So they named Kirby's actually named after one of Nintendo's lawyers in the US. But I just, overall, I really enjoyed a lot of the information. Look, I'll be honest, as someone who likes to read, you know, long-form articles, is fairly engaged, you know, I knew some of these things already.
Sure.
And some of the discussions around the games and things, it wasn't necessarily all new information, but I thought the way it was presented, and especially focusing around that spirit of play, I thought was a really nice way to look at it. Also, you know, I love anything that looks at kind of the early days of game development in the 80s and 90s, and that's where the book kind of starts out. And just, you know, remembering that there was a time when game designers really had to work within hardware and software limitations, and a lot of that shaped how certain things look or are now. Like Yoshi's design is very much a result of the fact that only a certain amount of pixels were available. So when Mario's riding Yoshi, you know, it could only be X pixels high. So, okay, what can, working within that, what can Yoshi even be? Like, it wasn't that someone said, let's make him like a dinosaur. It was like, okay, the shape, this is the shape we have.
Yeah, yeah.
What does that shape look like? And I find that stuff really, really interesting to kind of reflect on how far we've come.
It's like the QWERTY keyboard.
Yes. What about the QWERTY keyboard?
Yeah. Now you know, the original mechanical layout to help facilitate the keys not ramming into each other and getting stuck. And now it's become what it's still
it's the standard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and people look at on computers, they look at the little icon for saving files.
Yes.
What the hell is that?
Yeah. Like, it's a vending machine.
Yeah.
I do think the highlight and where the book hits its stride is in the chapter which does focus on Satoru Iwata, who was the CEO I mentioned before. And I think a lot of this ethos, you know, caring about the player, having good, solid designs, embracing fun, comes from his approach to running the company. Like, it's a top-down thing.
Mm.
And, you know, that all gamers should be treated equally, casual gamers, hardcore, quote-unquote, gamers. And I think very much so it's like, okay, it's not about building skills. When it's not about these barriers you have to overcome to be enjoying our games. It's like, it's truly for everybody. So I found the chapter on Iwata to be really moving. I thought that was a really nice at a position in the book too, to kind of, you're like, oh, I see how all of this has come together, all these like kind of magical elements just to make the perfect chemistry to allow a company to, yeah, just I take these risks and come out with these consoles and games that still bring a lot of joy today, like decades later. And I think Iwata had a quote, which I think is kind of a nice way to wrap this up. And it was, Nintendo's mission is to try to make people happy, to try to make people smile.
Oh.
I mean, what a great mission.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of shows in some of the business decisions that they've made over the years. So the book is Super Nintendo, How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. It's by Keza McDonald. It's a fairly recent release.
Mm.
I really enjoyed it. I do think that obviously if you feel you don't want to read a whole book about the history of Nintendo, I mean, it may not be for you, but I think it's really organized in a way that makes it just whiz by.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it talks a bit about the Animal Crossing surge of COVID era, and just it really reminds you that games have such a power for connection and community. And I think that's a really nice time to remember that, given that, you know, it's such a wide landscape now, and that not all patches are this fun and this focused on just making sure people enjoy gaming.
You know, there's a book about the Tamiya model-making company, which sounds very much like that, you know, hitting all the highlights along the way, but emphasising the fact that they want to have fun and they want people to buy the product to have fun.
Exactly.
And
the more the merrier, that kind of mindset.
Well, obviously that's good for profits, but at the same time, at the same time, I felt when I read that book that it gave me an insight into the idea of the craft over the company, you know, but at the same time, of course, they have to blend along the way.
Yes, it's like all of the elements, just the right amount of focus on each one to come together in this really nice mix. But anyway, I do recommend the book. I very much enjoyed it. Super Nintendo, How One Japanese Company Helped the World Have Fun. Let's take a little bit of music to lead us into
Animal Crossing,
the book that you're going to speak. Yes, look, I have to seize my opportunity whenever I can. We'll listen to a little bit of Animal Crossing Lo-Fi. This is a version by Jack the Pug.
Hello, this is Charlie Hayes. I've played several characters in various Big Finish audios, alongside, probably more famously, my Helena Bonham Carter gasp. Do you recognise it? You're listening to Zero G on 3RRR FM. Zero G, you heard it here first.
Yeah, we've been crossing with the animals there.
Yes, that was Animal Crossing Lo-Fi version by Jack the Pug in celebration of the book I just covered, Super Nintendo. And just another reminder that we still have a couple more days left of April Amnesty. And that is our annual drive to just remind you it's a great time to subscribe or donate to the station and to escape that crushing guilt of not subscribing. And I would say if you already are guilt-free and a happy subscriber, happy as a pig in mud, and you do have the means, you could throw us a little extra with a donation as well. That is always welcome during this time, and it all counts to keep us going as community-funded community radio.
And we promise that we won't send the boys around because they're far too busy facing off against Homelander. Episode of The Boys last night had a really great line. They were talking about plants using viruses to control human beings. Mm. One of the characters popped up and said, "Oh, like The Last of Us." And Frenchie replied quickly, No, that's just The Walking Dead with mushrooms." Where would you get that anywhere else on the planet but Zero G and Triple R FM? So, yeah.
It's true.
Okay, well, I want to mention the Fantastic Film Festival in Australia, which is out now, running between the Lido Cinemas, Thornbury Picture House and Brunswick Picture House. Started on the 23rd of April, going through to the 15th of May or the 12th of May, depending on which venue you're going to. Focusing upon alternative cinema, they've got Q&A screenings, they've got some classics, restorations and some short films and so on in contention in the competition that they've got there. And it's spread across screens in Melbourne and Sydney as well. So this is like all over the country. They've got Japanese Nightmares as one focus, seven films highlighting J-horror's impact on genre with films like Ichi the Killer from 2001, Onibaba from 1964, going through to Tetsuo, the Iron Man, which is a hell of a film if you've ever seen it, and a sequel. They've also got Vampire Weekend selections, which include Let the Right One In, the Swedish version. Although, actually, the US version is pretty good too.
It is pretty good, yeah.
That Romero classic Martin from 1977. Near Dark, you know, that rollicking Texicana sort of Western Vampire one, 1987, Nosferatu, the Vampire, and that's the Herzog one.
From the OG. Yeah,
the 79 one.
Well, not the OG, but yeah.
The OG.
And, not and, the recent one.
Yeah, and of course the Lost Boys as well. How can you not have that? Nice. The Rat Pack. and Twilight as well. And we'll pass on.
Twilight
as well, yeah, sparkling away there forever. And then there's also four feature-length Australian films screening in competition for a $10,000 cash prize, including Lenore, Wolf Cat Fever, Squids and Cruel Hands. Nice. And this is all at the Fantastic Film Festival 2026.
Nice.
Now, I'm going to roll forwards into the future, or float into the future, with a book called What We Can Know by Ian McEwan. It's Jonathan Cape, a.k.a. Penguin Random House imprint from 2025. Now, Ian Russell McEwan is a British novelist and screenwriter. Yonks lashes of books, a few short stories and so on to his name, many of which have been adapted into films or TV shows. You might know his novels, The Children Act, Nutshell, and Machines Like Me. And so this is his latest novel. And a while ago, I wrote that a science fiction novel set on Earth in the near to long-term future has to factor in anthropogenic climate change to be credible. And in looking at this book by McEwan, I'm never entirely sure if he intends global warming to be in the fore, the middle, or the background, as he sort of shifts the focus over the course of the story. But it's a deft shift. Not to worry, he consistently features the high ground as a necessary consequence of the United Kingdom in 2119 being transformed by rising sea levels into a series of diverse islands. So the British islands really lean into it there. But 22nd century civilization carries on, albeit transformed by the climate chaos of the 21st. On one island, Tom Metcalf is a scholar teaching in the literary section of the Arts and Humanities Department at a university. It's by no means the star department at the uni, a spot taken by the more immediately, urgently practical science-based faculties, who get the bulk of the funding, limited computer time and other resources, like AI is kind of restricted to people who really need to use it. Still, I take comfort from the fact that there's an official interest in the arts at all, which speaks well of a culture that would otherwise might be rather justified in completely focusing upon simple, sustainable survival after all they've been through during and after the derangement.
The derangement?
Yeah, of the past 100 years. So called because the people of those pre-inundation times, us, knew very well what harm they were literally baking into the future. But from the perspective of the ravaged future, inexplicably, we did not do enough to mitigate it.
Well,
so I'm afraid my solar panels are just not cutting it. Now, in one of the more whimsical setups I've encountered for a science fiction novel, Tom's primary historical academic literary interest is a legendary poem.
That's the McEwan of it all, I think.
A Corona for Vivian, written in 2014 by the eccentric poet Francis Blundy. as a gift for his wife's 54th. It was read out in public once, if you can call it public, because it was at a small party of luminary friends.
Of course, okay.
Which is now famous in the future. Mm-hmm. It has become known as the Second Immortal Dinner.
Oh.
Now, I pause to note that the First Immortal Dinner took place in 1817 in London, okay, hosted by Ben Hayden, the painter, with William Wordsworth, John Keats and Charles Lamb amongst the guest list.
Got it. Okay.
So the second scene from yet another century on is seen as equally intellectually pivotal, yeah, and it struck a chord. Now, the corona, as it's known, and that is actually a form of poetry as well that I won't go into. I'll let McEwan explain that in the book. It exists only as some admittedly well-remembered lines, quoted by its small but impressed audience, okay, and for the large negative space it left.
Oh.
So that's been filled by growing and endless speculation amongst the general literary and academic public.
Right.
The corona struck a chord by strikingly and powerfully entwining...
How could it be so enduring and yet not be remembered in full?
Well, it's like many things about that.
Yeah,
like
I guess some things get lost to time, or it's only the most colourful or strongest elements of a thing that persists and the rest gets, you know, fades away. But okay.
So what it's,
the concept.
What it's done is it, it entwines romantic and environmental themes in a fashion that's echoed down through the decades.
Right.
Resonating deeply with the zeitgeist, mm-hmm, and spawning enduring multimedia reflection online, on the screen, and in many books, both popular and esoteric. It's become a kind of a literary holy grail.
Okay, yeah.
Now, Tom is the latest in a long line of knowledge knights who desire to achieve this grail.
Intellectuals are funny.
Yeah. But unlike his dogged predecessors, he's lucky enough to be in the right place, mm-hmm, and time when a possible clue surfaces to the whereabouts of a copy of the precious poem. Mm. There's much more to it than that. And unlike,
it's on Tumblr. No.
Yeah.
Continue, sorry.
And unlike Ian McEwan, who wrote the book rather than merely reviewing it like I am, mm-hmm, I get to cut that long story shorter. Still, I have to underline the key fact that Tom's then partner and colleague, Rose, is a scholar in her own right, mm-hmm, instrumental in the quest, even though she doesn't initially physically accompany him.
Yep.
But this neatly reflects the relationship between the poet Francis,
yep,
and his wife Vivian, mm, who is so very, very much more above and beyond just being an artistic muse.
Yeah.
And who, in fact, is actually the main driver of the story.
Yeah.
Even 100 years on in their future.
This is a pattern in history, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not easy getting about the inundated land. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes it's as easy as getting on a ferry.
I was going to say, just a bunch of islands.
Yeah. But Tom is obsessed and a fan, and we know how that goes.
Well,
yeah. Arthurian...
One-track mind.
Yeah, pretty much. In fact, he does actually go up a track at one stage, one of those funicular railroads.
Oh, yeah.
Arthurian enthusiasts will well know that often the most interesting thing about the Holy Grail lies more in the quest. Yes. Rather than in the finding of the thing. And as an amused aside, knowing that several of Ian McEwan's stories have been adapted to the screen, I cannot help but think that Chris O'Dowd...
Oh, you think he'd be a good...
He'd be a good Tom.
Yeah.
I think he'd have the right amount of differing and indecisively offbeat energy.
Yeah.
And his range across the IT crowd and the big door prize and small town, big story would surely suggest he'd kind of gently, awkwardly nail it.
Yeah, like ramshackle intellectual. I can see it.
Following along that line, I'd really like to picture Tamsin Grigg from Black Books playing Rose. But I'm going to press pause on my fantasy casting there.
Well, let's put it out into the universe. I like that. Yeah, you know, who knows? Yeah.
Although anchored to a sharper point in the future, the story flashes back fluidly to our contemporary time, more or less, as Vivian and Francis's personal stories play out over several decades now.
Yep.
So if you've read McEwan's work or seen an adaptation, you'll know they often revolve around families under peculiar stresses and severe tensions and quite often a crime.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it is here. So
atonement.
Atonement. Megan's ballpark here. Crime. Vivian has a complicated backstory with her first husband before Francis, and there are many trapdoors open to us, the readers, that Tom cannot possibly enter from his position in the future. Even though he has fortunate access to quite a lot of archival material about the famous couple.
How fortunate for story purposes.
The reader should be prepared to spend a reasonable amount of time in remote libraries and other repositories. And yes, the literary detective story is also paralleled by the unravelling of one or perhaps more historical crimes. So McEwan's kind of modestly slash cheekily said that what we can know is science fiction without the science. And that's true to some extent. But on the other hand, I'm struck by the deftness of which he casually stuns with some memorable telling details. For example, from The Derangement, a character's chilled by video footage of a sinking, capsizing US American aircraft carrier with sailors sliding off its tilted flight deck into the water. And that's a scenario which cannot fail to immediately provoke emotion in any 2026 reader.
Yeah.
So let's have a track here. There is no sound.
On that note.
no soundtrack to this, but although that has happened in the past with novels. But I think I'll go with this one. It's called Shattered Garden, featuring Maggie Richardson. It is a song about climate change, and it is by the Steer Inspired Orchestra. And it's about a bird flying through a polluted landscape and hopefully looking forward to a better future. Or not. Yeah, that was a track called Shattered Garden featuring Maggie Richardson from the Steer Inspired Orchestra. Fly high, little bird. I hope you manage to get away from it all. All right, so finishing up on the book that I'm talking about, which is Ian McEwan's What Can We Know? It's a climate change novel. Well, the book's title encompasses the main question. What can we know about a climate-changed future 100 years hence? We can guess, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah.
And indeed, what can they know about a time 100 years past in that century? Well, everything and also nothing. And a lot in between, which is adequately covered in the novel, more than adequately. It's quite an intriguingly nuanced treatment of an unusual subject embedded in a future whose outlines are becoming all too familiar to us as we the deranged.
Yes.
So part cautionary tale well told and part catharsis, I would also think. I like the whimsy of it too with the subject matter.
Yeah.
I would also think in the particular case that it is cathartic because, you know, some great men assume that women and everyone else live in their shadows when it's actually the women who are the light source, especially in this story, I thought. It's a good book. Have it, give it a crack. Bit different for the science fiction fan, I normally I would think. We've been watching a few different things.
We'll close our books and turn on the TV again. But yes, I have finished last week. We had discussed Kaylee Z. Boston's limited horror series, Something Very Bad Is Going to Happen. And I think both Rob and I liked it quite a lot. I was almost at the end. I think I had just the final episode to go and a little bit of the penultimate episode. And oh boy, did it, I feel, stick the landing. Yes. I really, really think that it's a strong series. I enjoyed it a lot. And in a way, obviously no spoilers. I'm not going to spoil anything about the ending. I think that's quite important here because the series does spend a lot of time building tension, dropping tidbits, really getting you to embody the mindset of Rachel as she goes through the lead up to her wedding amongst some very ominous, strange occurrences and revelations and secrets and all of that in this sort of snow-covered cabin out in the woods. I think that, you know, when I got to the final kind of climax of the whole thing, I was like, yeah, I think this is a really great way for this to be resolved. And I appreciated everything the series had done until that point. It doesn't shy away from really going in, like, it's... It doesn't blink, I think. I think I respect where it went and I respect kind of the decisions it made. I thought the kind of the core messaging, because obviously it starts to emerge that it's very much about, you know, marriage and wedding jitters maybe, and are you with the person you should be with? I think it leaning on the horror themes to express all of those ideas was done really well and enjoyably. Some stuff less enjoyable to watch.
I found hilarious, because it is actually satirical and blackly comedic.
It is,
places.
Yes.
I found it hilarious that one particular couple ended up being, were soulmates.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, actually you can see they're made for each other.
Totally. And I think that the way, you know, the series is giving little winks here and there, but while also not shying away from some pretty gruesome, gory fun.
Did you notice, and this is not really a spoiler, but in a scene near the end where a character is driving away from the, let's be honest, the chalet in the woods.
Yes.
Where they're driving away from it, there's a three-legged fox in the background.
Yes, I did. I do think that, you know, there's a few bits. I enjoyed that tidbit. I think there's a few bits where they definitely said, okay, we're going to make this sort of metaphor quite clear. Mm. But I also think that overall it was a really solid, unexpected series. Highly recommend. I think all of the acting really sells it as well. It was nice to see there was a lot of actors in here who I wasn't familiar with, but I do think everyone did such a great job of creating that atmosphere and you know, everyone got a different ending, and I feel pretty happy mostly with how it all ended up. Something Very Bad is going to happen. It is on Netflix. It's 8 episodes long. Definitely a bit of a slow burn at the start, so you've got to wait till you get to maybe episode 4, and that's when sort of the change kicks in and we get the action really propels you until the end. So,
and speaking of action and great shows, still watching Daredevil Born Again season 2. Yes. Oh my god, that is so good.
I'm glad it's still holding strong.
Yeah, it's not pulling any punches either. And the most marvelous thing about the most recent episode is Jessica Jones returns.
Oh.
With some changes rung to her personality, some of which makes sense, but a lot of which makes sense if you've been reading the comics or know from that. But
we'll
talk about that later on when the season ends, which is coming up relatively soon too. Mm-hmm. Oh, so much to talk about.
There's a lot of good stuff out there right now.
But we are going to go out now with, I was thinking about something that had an environmental sort of theme to it. David Bowie, 5 years, 2017 remastered version, live, so it's a bit archival. And, sort of way back in the day, sort of kind of echoing the environmental movement at the same time, although I'm not really sure that Bowie was as such referencing that. But, you know, you have some lyrics in this that do go with that. I think Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. We could all be spiders on Mars one day, I suppose. All right, so coming up next is Joe Brunetic with Astral Glamour. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you, Rob.
Yeah, that was a track called Shattered Garden featuring Maggie Richardson from the Steer-inspired orchestra. Fly high, little bird. I hope you managed to get away from it all. Mm. All right, so finishing up on the book that I'm talking about, which is Ian McEwan's What Can We Know? It's a climate change novel. Mm-hmm. The book's title encompasses the main question. What can we know about a climate-changed future 100 years hence? Mm-hmm. We can guess, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah.
And indeed, what can they know about a time 100 years past in that century? Well, everything and also nothing. And a lot in between, which is adequately covered in the novel, more than adequately. It's quite an intriguingly nuanced treatment of an unusual subject embedded in a future whose outlines are becoming all too familiar to us we the deranged.
Yes.
So part cautionary tale well told and part catharsis, I would also think. I like the whimsy of it too with the subject matter.
Yeah.
I would also think in the particular case that it is cathartic because, some great men assume that women and everyone else live in their shadows when it's actually the women who are the light source, especially in this story, I thought. It's a good book. Give it a crack. A bit different for the science fiction fan, I would think. We've been watching a few different things.
We'll close our books and turn on the TV again. But yes, I have finished. Last week we had discussed Kaylee Z. Boston's limited horror series, Something Very Bad Is Going to Happen. Mm-hmm. And I think both Rob and I liked it quite a lot. I was almost at the end. I think I had just the final episode to go and a little bit of the penultimate episode. Mm-hmm. And oh boy, did it, I feel, stick the landing. Yes. I really, really think that it's a strong series. I enjoyed it a lot. And in a way, obviously no spoilers. I'm not going to spoil anything about the ending. I think that's quite important here because the series does spend a lot of time building tension, dropping tidbits, really getting you to embody the mindset of Rachel as she goes through the lead up to her wedding, amongst some very ominous, strange occurrences and revelations and secrets and all of that in this sort of snow-covered cabin out in the woods. I think that, you know, when I got to the final kind of climax of the whole thing, I was like, yeah, I think this is a really great way for this to be resolved. And I appreciated everything the series had done until that point. It doesn't shy away from really going in. Like, it doesn't blink, I think. I think I respect where it went, and I respect kind of the decisions it made. I thought the kind of the core messaging, because obviously it starts to emerge that it's very much about, you know, marriage and wedding jitters maybe, and are you with the person you should be with? I think it leaning on the horror themes to express all of those ideas was done really well and enjoyably. some stuff less enjoyable to watch.
I found hilarious, because it is actually satirical and blackly comedic.
It is,
places.
Yes.
I found it hilarious that one particular couple ended up being were soulmates.
Yeah.
And I thought, actually you can see they're made for each other.
Totally. And I think that the way, you know, the series is giving little winks here and there, but while also not shying away from some pretty gruesome, gory fun.
Did you notice, and this is not really a spoiler, but in a scene near the end where a character is driving away from the, let's be honest, the chalet in the woods.
Yes.
Where they're driving away from it, there's
the
a three-legged fox in the background.
Yes, I did. I do think that, you know, there's a few bits. I enjoyed that tidbit. Mm. I think there's a few bits where they definitely said, okay, we're going to make this sort of metaphor quite clear. Mm. But I also think that overall it was a really solid, unexpected series. Highly recommend. I think all of the acting really sells it as well. It was nice to see there was a lot of actors in here who I wasn't familiar with, but I do think everyone did such a great job of creating that atmosphere, and you know, everyone got a different ending, and I feel pretty happy mostly with how it all ended up. Mm. Something very bad is going to happen. It is on Netflix. It's 8 episodes long. Definitely a bit of a slow burn at the start, so you've got to wait till you get to maybe episode 4, and that's when sort of the change kicks in and we get the action really propels you until the end. So,
and speaking of action and great shows, still watching Daredevil Born Again season 2.
Yes.
Oh my God, that is so good.
I'm glad it's still holding strong.
Yeah, it's not pulling any punches either. And the most marvelous thing about the most recent episode is Jessica Jones returns.
Oh.
With some changes rung to her personality, some of which makes sense, but a lot of which makes sense if you've been reading the comics or know from that. But
happy to have her back.
Talk about that later on when the season ends, which is coming up relatively soon too. Mm-hmm. Oh, so much to talk about.
There's a lot of good stuff out there right now.
But we are going to go out now with, I was thinking about something that had an environmental sort of theme to it. David Bowie, 5 years, 2017 remastered version, live, so it's a bit archival. And, you know, sort of way back in the day, sort of kind of echoing the environmental movement at the same time, although I'm not really sure that Bowie was as such referencing that. But, you know, you have some lyrics in this that do go with that. I think it was Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. We could all be spiders on Mars one day, I suppose. All right, so coming up next is Joe Brunetic with Astral Glamour. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you, Rob.
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast at Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.